Unfortunately, with dining, is by the very nature of the activity, you are not going to wear your face covering while you're there for the vast majority of the time, because you are eating and drinking.
County Public Health Director Barbara Ferrer, no more outdoor dining in Los Angeles County. That was announced yesterday by her department, and they've shut it down for the next 3 weeks. That'll begin Wednesday at 10 p.m. Restaurants are still allowed to sell food to go, but this is obviously a huge hit to an industry that is barely hanging on as is. Let's find out how one restaurateur is planning to adapt. Greg Amsler is the owner of Salt Creek Grill in Valencia, and he was able to turn his large patio and outdoor waiting area into additional dining space, which I guess now, Greg, will not be used.
Unfortunately not. And thanks for inviting me on here. But no, that that was a bit of a body blow yesterday. We had just spent not only the expense, but also the time and effort of doing all this. And to have it shut down just as we're going into the busiest time of the year is a little rough.
Right, a little. Well, probably a lot of rough for a lot of people. What are you planning to do? Do you have to lay off staff?
Yeah, unfortunately, we'll be going through our second round of layoffs. Unfortunately, some of the or most of the people that were laid off before have used most of their unemployment benefits, so I'm not sure what's going to be happening as far as what they can do, but we will definitely be down to about 10 to 15% of our staff.
Oh, my gosh. And these are some of the people who are living paycheck to paycheck, right? I mean, these are like busboys and food runners and servers and line cooks and people like that.
Absolutely. And we have I have a number of single mothers that have not only had to deal with trying to survive the in-home learning, but also to work also and to kind of find the time to do both. And it's going to be a rough patch. Hopefully it's only going to be for 3 weeks. I seriously hope that that's all it's going to take.
Yeah. Well, that is dependent upon all of us to stop the spread of this disease.
Yeah. And I guess that's kind of what makes it a little frustrating is I sincerely believe the industry as a whole has done a very, very good job of sticking to the guidelines, doing what we were supposed to do, putting up the barriers, spending the extra money and the extra time, wearing the masks, wearing the face shields, gloves, and it kind of, I don't know if we were singled out, but it kind of feels like that sometimes.
Hmm. Well, I mean, just anecdotally, I think people can see that the restaurant workers are masked up and seem to be safe, taking the precautions, but it's the patrons who aren't doing that. So they're maybe taking off their masks, as Barbara Ferrer said, for the entire time they're sitting at the table and they're in close proximity to people who may not be in their household. So is it more about the patrons?
It could be.
That they didn't follow the rules?
We started the outdoor dining where, and when we were open for a short period of time with the indoor limited dining, the patrons have to wear masks if they're up from their table. And I know the guidelines came and said to, you know, basically put on your mask between bites and, you know, between sips, I guess. That's a little hard to do, and it's obviously hard for us to enforce. The question I have is, if you can't go out to eat, is this going to force people to go and congregate at other people's homes that may be much less safe than you would at a restaurant?
Yeah. So, as you say, this is a terrible moment for this to be happening, the holidays. How much had you invested in preparing for Thanksgiving and the rest of the holiday season?
Unfortunately, we had kind of pre-bought a lot of our dry goods, canned goods, stuff that we would need. Thanksgiving for us is one of the busiest days of the year, probably the third busiest day of our year. And we were stocking up on a lot of our non-perishables. But also, we put up a couple of tents outside because it had started getting a little bit cooler at night, and also invested in 12 stand-up heaters with the propane tanks. That's the, you know, some of the expense that we're not going to be able to get back. But as far as the food's concerned, we're still anticipating a really good takeout day because nobody can go out. And if you haven't already planned on cooking, you might not be able to at this point. So the problem is we're going right into the busiest time of the year, and it's going to be a little tough for everybody.
Yeah, and so I was reading a really angry Twitter thread from David Chang, who, you know, the restaurateur who founded Momofuku, among other restaurants. And he, you know, it's profanity laced, but he's just fed up with our elected officials of both parties for not providing a safety net for restaurant workers, not helping out the businesses, not actually getting this thing under control in the big picture. How do you feel about what our elected officials have and have not been doing, and what would you like to see from them?
I wholly agree with there not being a safety net. I think the landscape in our industry is going to look completely different 6 months from now, a year from now, whenever we're back to a semblance of normal. I'm an independent. I don't have other restaurants that we can pool resources, capital, equipment, whatever you may be able to share. It's me by myself, which is what 90% of the restaurants and bars are out there. And to just shut it down and say, sorry, you're on your own, that's tough. There should be some type of, whether you call it a safety net, but some type of backup system where if we do A, then we can do B, or if we can do B, then C is implemented, that kind of thing. This just seems like you're shut down, there's nothing you can do about it, sorry, we'll reevaluate in 3 weeks.
Well, that is what it is. I mean, there's no sugarcoating that.
No. And
there's no help on the horizon from the feds, or I don't think from the state either.
Yeah, I haven't heard anything, but it couldn't come fast enough, because it's not going to come very quickly. If it hasn't been already debated and talked about and discussed and implemented, it's going to take a while.
How much longer do you think you can hang on? Can you survive this, do you think?
Well, I certainly hope so. So far, yes. And again, it's going to depend on, is it going to be 3 weeks or is it going to be 6 weeks? It's hard for me to believe that in the middle of the Christmas season, they're going to open everything back up. If they're scared of the Thanksgiving, the Christmas season to me is even more of a gathering, more of a festive atmosphere. I just don't see it happening until after the first of the year, after all the holidays are done. If that's the case, that could be tough. I believe I will survive. We've done some things to kind of prepare for this, but there'll be a lot of mom and pops and a lot of independents out there that you won't see open anymore.
That is sad. It is tragic, and I'm really sorry this is happening on many levels. Greg Amsler, owner of Salt Creek Grill in Valencia, best of luck to you, and thanks for coming on the show today.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Coming up, how Vermont was able to tame the virus and reopen all its schools. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. As coronavirus cases surge across the country, hospitals are running dangerously close to capacity. In California, Santa Clara County announced over the weekend that could be in about 3 weeks from now. Even some of the nation's best prepared hospitals are bracing for catastrophe. The University of Nebraska Medical Center in Omaha is one such study. It has the only federal quarantine facility. It's where Ebola patients were treated back in 2014 and where some American COVID patients from the Diamond Princess cruise ship went. They have long conducted pandemic drills at this hospital, but even now, they are overwhelmed. With me to talk about this is Ed Yong, science writer for The Atlantic, and he recently wrote about the University of Nebraska Medical Center. Welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, how did this hospital initially prepare for COVID?
So they started all the way back in 2003 when the original SARS virus started sweeping the world. Some of their staff, including some of the best infectious disease doctors around, recognized that there was a crucial need to prepare for emerging infections. And they really did. They had the best facilities, the best people. They drilled, they trained, they built contingencies and contingencies on top of their contingencies. Like they're the best. I visited them in 2018 when writing about whether America was going to be prepared for a new pandemic. Spoilers, no. But they were as ready as they could have been, and yet it's not enough. You know, people at UNMC have told me just the last week that they are on a catastrophic path, that they are watching a system breaking in front of them, that they will reach, they're rapidly approaching a point when they can no longer care for all the patients who need care. And that type of talk from people at this particular hospital should shake the entire nation. It shows how bad things have got.
Yeah, because if even they are facing this, imagine what the lesser prepared hospitals are facing. In fact, hospitals in Nebraska, rural hospitals or hospitals in other parts of the state, are they trying to send patients to this hospital and are they being turned away, these patients?
Yeah, absolutely. The UNMC has had to turn down requests from other smaller rural hospitals or even hospitals from other states who have no capacity. You know, this is a problem throughout the Midwest in particular and throughout the US in general. The whole country is on fire because of this third surge, which is very different from the previous surges. Like in spring, New York could seek help from the rest of the country and they could get nurses and doctors flying in to help them out. Now, no reinforcements are in the way. So doctors and nurses aren't moving and patients aren't moving either because there are no spare, there's just very little spare capacity. So it's a terrible situation. And this is what it is right now. You know, there is a 12-day lag between rises in cases and rises in hospitalizations. We've seen that throughout the year with this pandemic. And so what this means is that over the last 12 days, around 1.5 million Americans have been infected or been confirmed as infected. And that number does not factor in to these horror stories that I'm telling you right now about hospitals that are about what hospitals are currently going through. That extra 1.5 million cases, some of those will slam into those besieged hospitals over the next 2 weeks over the Thanksgiving period, and deaths are going to soar as a result.
And then if people are getting together on Thanksgiving and spread the virus, then 2 weeks later, maybe around what, December 10th onwards, we'll see another huge wave of hospitalizations.
Yep, and a wave of deaths just before Christmas. That's exactly right. This is probably the worst phase of the pandemic so far. And I want everyone to understand that, you know, you hear stories of, you hear things about how most people survive this virus, that death rates have fallen over the course of the year. This is true. And that comes down to the knowledge and skill and increasing savvy of our healthcare workers. And those people are exhausted and burning out, and some of them are dying or quitting because they can't take the stress anymore. So that wave in after Thanksgiving and coming into Christmas, there is absolutely no guarantee that the low death rates we've seen over the summer will continue. In fact, they will probably rise. And people will die as a result because there just won't be anyone to care for them, no beds to put them in. It's not just COVID patients, it's people coming in with heart attacks, strokes, cancers. Some of them are already not getting the care they need. They will be deferred even further, and then they will come into the hospital much sicker when there is actually space for them.
On top of that, COVID patients need a lot more care than regular ICU patients, and they stay longer, too. So that adds to the stress and to the burnout and the workload of the healthcare professionals.
Yeah, that's correct. I still think that a lot of people have this idea of just someone's, you know, in a hospital bed, kind of passive on a ventilator, you can leave them alone. That is so far from reality as to be laughably absurd. Like a COVID patient in an ICU probably has is connected up to a ventilator. So they've got a long tube going into their lungs that are providing them with oxygen and saving their lives. They have probably 8 to 12 other tubes going straight into their heart and other major blood vessels, giving them pain relievers, sedatives, antibiotics. None of these drugs are for actually treating the COVID. That's just for keeping them alive. Every day, a team of six or seven doctors will have to turn them onto their front and then turn them back and again at a different point. Some nurse will have to look at all of those 8 to 12 drugs and adjust their doses, maybe even on a minute-by-minute level. So an ICU nurse normally can handle two patients. If that one of those patients is COVID, then a nurse can handle one patient. And that patient will be in that ICU for three times as long as any normal patient. COVID patients are among the sickest people that some of these healthcare workers have ever had to treat. And their numbers are going to rise in the near-term future.
Do you think that part of this is, well, there's pandemic fatigue, obviously. People are just sick of being holed up in their homes and they want to socialize. But is also part of it that they're hearing this vaccine news and thinking, well, we're right around the corner from getting a vaccine, so let's just, you know, throw caution to the wind?
I think it's more to do with the ridiculous policies that a lot of governors and the Trump administration have put into place. Like, I think on a fundamental level, a lot of people, even not even counting the ones who think like this is a hoax, or, you know, who don't believe that COVID exists, even the ones who actually understand the stakes, see that, you know, see restaurants and bars open, see gyms open, you know, see colleges admitting students. And I think people just have this intuitive sense that if the government allows them to do something, then that thing is safe. And so you have governors in states like Nebraska and Iowa that are completely full of staff, you know, out of staffed beds, and who are saying, oh, don't go into crowded places, don't eat out, don't, you know, don't go into restaurants and, you know, and spend huge amounts of time in proximity with your family. But their policies are completely nullifying all of that because they are allowing people to do all those things. And those lax policies, more than anything else, I think, have truly led this country down a disastrous path. And, you know, it is, I cannot stress enough now, it is too late to avert what is going to happen in the next 2 weeks because of these lags that I've talked about. The near-term future is set and it looks disastrous. But through our actions, we can spare healthcare workers and hospitals further grief in December. That's what's at play now. We get to collectively decide by things like wearing a mask, staying at home, not traveling for Thanksgiving, how many people are even alive next year to receive a vaccine, and how many healthcare workers burn out in the process.
You know, I hear the frustration in your voice, and we've had you on periodically since this pandemic began. And I guess you must be at your wit's end, having to say this over and over again. Just can you reflect on what it's been like for you to be doing this kind of reporting over the last, well, almost a year now?
I mean, it's been really hard. I mean, like, I am very thankful for the opportunity to be of service to the country and to, you know, my friends and my loved ones and all of our readers. I do believe that good journalism has the potential to save lives right now. And I've had readers write in expressing the same thought. But this has been absolutely ruinous for my mental health. And, you know, it's not just staring tragedy in the face all the time, but it's also the constant gaslighting from policymakers, from people who do think it's a hoax, from, you know, everyone from some rando on Twitter to the president of the United States. But these are the stakes. You know, I am a science journalist. I've spent my entire career trying to resist alarmism and trying to give accurate, honest, fact-based reporting to people. And so when I'm telling you now that people are in my ear crying because they can't handle the amount of death that they're seeing, and they're telling me that the healthcare systems that they're working in are about to collapse, I am not exaggerating. I'm not doing anything alarmist. I'm not fear-mongering. And if you feel fear, you should feel fear right now because it's a terrible situation that we are facing. But we do, and I stress this again, have a chance to save lives in the coming months.
Ed, thank you for coming on today.
All right. Thank you so much.
That's Ed Yong, science writer for The Atlantic. Well, as COVID continues to surge uncontrolled across the country and hospitals are stretched thin, rural, sparsely populated states are really bearing the brunt of it. Wyoming, the Dakotas, some of the highest rates of new cases per capita in the country. And last week, the Federation of American Scientists said North Dakota has the highest COVID-19 death rate in the world. South Dakota is number three. But then there's another sparsely populated rural state in northern New England that has done almost everything right. Vermont, just 3,600 cases total since the start of the pandemic and only 63 deaths. We're going to talk about what Vermont did right with Anne Sossen. She's program director at the Center for Global Health Equity at Dartmouth, and she's been studying Vermont's response to COVID-19, and she also lives there. Lucky you, Anne.
Thanks, Madeline, for having me on the show today.
Welcome to the program. Well, there are a lot of factors that could make Vermont vulnerable, right? It's got an older population, a lot of cold weather, meaning people are forced to be indoors, and some of the same risk factors we see in states like the Dakotas. So what makes Vermont different?
So I think a lot of things make Vermont different. I think Vermont's leaders recognized early on the threats that COVID-19 represented to a rural state like Vermont and took very early action. The state's leadership instituted stay-at-home orders very early on in the pandemic. And these responses were also supported by the action of the state's health system, social service agencies, and communities. And this early action, you know, played a really key role in averting that initial surge of infections in the state.
The state of Vermont has a Republican governor, Phil Scott, and we've seen Republicans in other states kind of dismiss taking preventive approaches to combating this virus, you know, not implementing mask orders and stay-at-home orders and things like that. So why is Phil Scott sort of bucking his fellow Republicans on this?
Phil Scott has really led not only Republican governors, but I would say, you know, governors across the country in his response to COVID-19. And he, you know, has really depoliticized the response. You know, he has really been led by the public health guidance that he's received from the state's public health leadership. And that's really, you know, made quite a difference in the outcomes that we've seen here.
Well, how was Vermont able to rally the entire state around sort of staying at home, wearing masks, social distancing, things that other governors, including our governor here in California, have found it difficult to do because there have been very loud and very vocal pockets of resistance?
You know, Phil Scott often speaks to what he calls the Vermont way, or this way of coming together as a state to confront the challenges facing Vermonters. There's a high degree of social cohesion across, you know, the state's communities. There's quite a bit of community infrastructure. You know, communities have a long tradition of coming together and engaging in civic activities. And that was really important very early in the response. He was able to build on those strengths. I think what's been more important, though, has been how the state has been able to sustain this response over a very long period of time. Certainly that early success was something that Vermonters wanted to preserve. But, you know, it hasn't simply been a practice of, you know, maintaining social distancing and masking, but also thinking about what are the coherent set of actions that are being required of Vermonters as, you know, they open schools and the economy over time.
Well, have they been able to reopen the economy?
Yes, Vermont opened its economy very slowly in early summer, and it's also been able to open its schools and campuses to in-person instruction.
When it comes to getting back to school, does that look different than pre-pandemic? Do the classrooms look different? Are the kids wearing masks? Are there different ways of carrying out the instruction, as staggered schedules, for example, or is it what it was pre-pandemic?
Yes, it looks radically different. Kids are universally masked across schools. There's social distancing in classrooms. Most schools, I would say, have altered the way that they instruct students. In some ways, some schools are using hybrid models to limit the number of students in the classroom. Others are, you know, have all children in school at the same time, but are adopting different modes of organizing their school. So there have been sort of significant changes to school operations to bring children back to school.
So Vermont is obviously a small state population-wise compared to California, for example. But are there lessons that we could adopt here in California?
I think that there are lessons for every state. You know, good policy is good policy. Good leadership is good leadership. I think one thing that's been really critical to Vermont's success is having really clear guidance that governs every sector of activity. And that includes educational sectors, but also, you know, the ways that businesses are reopening and operating. The state recently developed guidance for recreational activities as well. And so that's one thing that's been really critical to Vermont's success. I think a second thing that's really important is having a very clear plan to manage the pandemic. You know, it's important to define what the goals are of the public health response, as well as the set of actions that are required to achieve them. Vermont, you know, defined those early goals of suppressing infections down to a very low rate. But then for the second phase of its response, you know, defined a, you know, another set of goals that were clearly communicated to the population. I'd say the third thing is that the messaging coming down from state leadership has been really effective in enlisting the population as key partners in the response. You know, Vermonters have a sense of hope and agency as, you know, they make these daily sacrifices necessary to achieve these goals. They believe that it's possible to stem transmission and that their actions are really critical to the success of the state. They are not simply engaging in social distancing and masking for the purpose of stemming transition, but rather for the purpose of opening schools, for preserving businesses, and for doing other things that will result in tangible improvements to their lives.
Yeah. I mean, I think we all want that, right? We all want to be able to send our kids back to school, to reopen businesses, to resume somewhat normal activity. But it just feels like we don't know how to do that. Like we open up and then the cases come up again. And so we have to close down again. And it's this very seesaw approach. And I guess our leaders here and in many other states don't really know what else to do.
Certainly. I think it's easy to feel somewhat resigned to, you know, a resurgence of cases and closures again. And that's, you know, one thing that we continue to hear from state's leadership is, yes, this is challenging. We know that we're asking sacrifices from you, but there will be benefits that result from the sacrifices that we're asking you to make.
Right. I think people have heard that, but there's just this fatigue. I can't do it anymore. I want to see my family on Thanksgiving.
Certainly. And we're seeing that here as well. That's a clear challenge that Vermont is also confronting.
Anne Sossen from the Center for Global Health Equity at Dartmouth. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me on the show today.
Coming up, a new documentary on Frank Zappa, his music and his political activism.
With the platform that he had, he talked about it, sang about it, and wrote music to get people to think for themselves and to try to make a difference.
Plus, the Legal Eagle, Jessica Levinson, is here with the latest on the election lawsuits. All that next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The Trump campaign is still waging legal fights in a few swing states to try to turn the election results in the president's favor, even as his already narrow path to forcing a win becomes even narrower. On Friday, Georgia certified its election results. And yet, President Trump wants yet another recount in that state. On Saturday, a federal judge in Pennsylvania tossed out a suit there with a scathing rebuke of the campaign's legal argument. In all, the Trump campaign has been on the losing side of about 30 legal challenges. Here with an update is Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School and our regular Legal Eagle here on Press Play. Hi.
Hi. Well, when you introduce it like that, it almost sounds like there's been an enormous amount of post-election litigation.
I know. And it is a little head spinning, just the sheer volume of it and the sheer, I guess, incredulity in some quarters that this is still happening. Let's begin with Pennsylvania. What did the judge say in his scathing rebuke?
I mean, what did the judge not say in the scathing rebuke? So I read this right before dinner Saturday night, as one does, and my jaw literally dropped. It's very rare to see a judge who is not just running a tanker truck over the legal arguments, but then backing up, getting a bus, and then getting a van to make sure, no, you're really dead. And, you know, what everybody is citing is this line where he describes the legal arguments as equivalent to Frankenstein's monster, which is essentially, he said, you had these two really bad arguments and then you put them together and you thought you were going to fool me. Well, I've got some news for you. And it's a very methodical conclusion in the sense that the judge starts by saying that this is unsupported by the claims here are unsupported by the law or by any of the facts, and then goes through point by point. And what I think is really remarkable is the court says, well, here's why you lose on standing. And okay, let's assume you win on standing. You also lose on your big argument of equal protection. Mm-hmm. And we know how the judge feels because the judge took the somewhat unusual step of saying, this is dismissed with prejudice, meaning you can't try and refile another case on the same grounds. And I'm denying your motion for leave to amend, meaning you can't try and add facts to this complaint. I've seen everything I need to say. We're all done here.
Oh, my gosh. And this had to do with mail-in votes in the state and the Trump campaign wanted 7 million votes thrown out. I mean, they do seem to be going for sort of a wholesale rejection of the vote in some of these cases, like Wisconsin, for example. What's happening there?
Yeah, well, and the Pennsylvania case was actually interesting because it dealt with all of the ballots, but it said don't, what they asked for is they said don't certify, which is a mm-hmm. really weird remedy to ask for when Pennsylvania very likely will certify and therefore the case will be moot as of today. So in Wisconsin, what are we seeing here? I mean, we're seeing kind of more of the same, but we're seeing that the Trump campaign wants a recount of two of the very heavily Democratic counties. And what they want, and specifically, is they want to say there are some absentee ballots that were cast before Election Day with people who actually walked in person to the polling place instead of putting their absentee ballots in the mail. And we think you should trash all of those. The reporting that I saw this morning is what? This would actually invalidate the ballots cast by the attorney making this argument and his wife.
I mean, if it wasn't so serious, because it is about our democracy, it is almost a parody of itself. What is, on the face of it, wrong with walking an absentee ballot in personally instead of putting it in a mailbox?
Can I just say, how many times have we said, if it didn't deal with the fate of our country and our democracy, it would be actually kind of funny. So what's wrong with that? Absolutely nothing. I mean, I wish I could say, well, here's what they're trying to argue here. But what they're really trying to just do is say that there's something suspect about these absentee ballots that instead of arriving through the mail, which the Trump campaign has said is suspect, that there's some problem with them arriving in person, that the procedures would have broken down. And I know this sounds like a partisan statement, and I hope it's really instead read as a legal statement, but there's nothing to indicate that that's the case. How do we know that for sure? We're targeting just these heavily Democratic areas. And let's mm-hmm. all remember, and I'm sorry for repeating this, but you can flip Wisconsin and you won't, but you can flip Wisconsin and it doesn't change the outcome of this race. Same thing is true for Pennsylvania. You're looking at 2 to 3 states at least that you'd have to change the outcome of the states to change the outcome of the race.
Okay. Finally, we have about a minute left. Joe Biden says he's going to appoint Alejandro Mayorkas to head the Department of Homeland Security. He is a graduate of your institution, of Loyola Law School. So what do you know about him?
I know that today he certainly has a higher profile than I do as a graduate of Loyola Law School. So what I know is that he has a sterling reputation, that he worked for the U.S. Attorney's Office, then he became the U.S. Attorney in the Central District. He worked in private practice, then worked in the Obama administration. What do people really remember from his work in the Obama administration? That he was instrumental in two things that President Trump has railed against. One is implementing DACA, which obviously creates the category of dreamers, people who are brought to this country as minors illegally and are given work permits and the ability to stay. The other is opening up relations with Cuba. He was born in Cuba, and it really is a rebuke of President Trump's policies to nominate him. It's saying there's going to be something very different here.
All right. Interesting. More to come on him and the new administration. Jessica Levinson. And let me just note, there is only one legal eagle. He is not the legal eagle. You are. Jessica Levinson teaches law at Loyola Law School. And she's on Press Play every week as our legal eagle. Coming up, a really behind-the-scenes look at the life of Frank Zappa. His son and the director of a new documentary on Zappa are here next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Frank Zappa was the sardonic anti-hero of LA's music scene back in the 1960s. He was a relentless workaholic during a time when rock stars were laid back. He didn't drink. He didn't use drugs, unlike most of his neighbors in Laurel Canyon. And he didn't really care about getting his songs on the radio.
But once you find that the way you lied and all the corny tricks you tried will not forestall the rising tide of hungry freaks, daddy.
A new documentary takes an intimate look at Frank Zappa. It uses footage from the musician's extensive personal archive. The movie is called Zappa. It's directed by Alex Winter and produced by Frank's son, Amit Zappa. And they both join me now. Welcome.
Thank you.
So happy to be here. Hi, guys.
Great to have you. All right. So, Alex, let's begin with you. And you had access to all of this archival material. Can you just describe what that entailed? All that archive?
Well, a lot. I pitched this idea to Gail Zappa about almost 6 years ago. And
she's Frank's widow.
That was Frank's widow, who was a force of nature unto herself. She's since passed from cancer. And the idea that I had was really not a music doc. It was really much more an examination of an artist at that period of history. And she really liked the idea, but said, you know, that there was really no way to do it without the vault material, because there was so little of Zappa out in the world that spoke to his internal life. And the vault is literally a painstaking Alexandria library of all things Zappa, from before his birth to his death. That was absolutely archived and curated by him, and included everything from artwork that he made, photographs, costumes, props, every conceivable kind of film media, 8mm, Super 8, 16, 35, every type of video. And again, this is not stuff he had a staff doing. This is all his handwriting on the side. And it was, you know, it was amazing to see, and a blessing and a curse. From the standpoint that there was an enormous amount to go through, and some of that material was very old and in danger of deterioration. We had stuff down there that machines don't exist anymore. We'd often joke that there'd be like that one guy that has the only existing machine and it's not too far off. It'd be like some guy in his mom's basement, like, "Mom, leave me alone. I'm transferring the last bit of footage, you know, for the Zappa doc." You know, like, they don't even make the chemicals anymore.
One thing I didn't really realize about him was just how invested and interested he was in classical music. And he recorded an album with the LA Philharmonic, for example, in the 1970s. And he was never classically trained. He never went to music school. He never received formal lessons, from what I can understand. How did he learn how to compose classical music?
He went to the library and taught himself. You know, he was just a student of his, I guess, as his own curiosity, his desire to learn things, create things. He followed his passions, and you know, if he didn't have the resources, and growing up, they lived in the projects. There's no advantages given to Frank. He had to figure it all out on his own.
The thing is that Zappa really started as a filmmaker in terms of his artistic output. And I mean, as a child and then as an early teen. And that discipline moved its way over editing film, which he loved to do. And we had a lot of it. That really transferred itself over to orchestral composition, which is not dissimilar in many ways. And the rock, and I mean, he loved the different types of music, and he was inspired by everything from Ernie Kovacs and Spike Jones to Verez and Stravinsky. But the rock didn't come until much later.
So he forms this band, Mothers of Invention, and I just want to play a clip of him talking about this band.
A lot of what we do is designed to annoy people to the point where they might just for a second question enough of their environment to do something about it. As long as they don't feel their environment and they don't worry about it, they're not going to do anything to change it. And something's got to be done.
What was his relationship to politics, and how did he see the relationship between politics and his music? Did he see them as inextricable?
I think that he was, whatever he was interested in, he put into his art. And if he's looking around him in society and seeing people being mistreated, you know, my father, I think he's a superhero. He fought for the underdog later on in his life. There's so many examples of that, and specifically the PMRC. But earlier on, you know, as music was changing and evolving, and you know, kids, teenagers were being beat up in the streets in California for dressing differently, behaving differently, growing their hair long. You know, it's a really different time back then. And I don't think that he liked what he was seeing. And with the platform that he had, he talked about it, sang about it, and wrote music to get people to think for themselves and to try to make a difference.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, he from the perspective of the archive material that we were working with, it was really clear that there was a political and cultural awareness from the beginning. Though I do think he matured greatly politically over the course of his life, and had a kind of a moment of reconciliation with the reality that you can't, as a popular artist, just write music about this stuff. If you care enough, you actually have to put on a suit and go down to Washington and do something about it. And from the moment that he first set foot into the Senate with the censorship hearings, which he essentially won their case single-handedly, it wasn't the end. It was really the beginning of him having to commit much more time to activism, which he did. Mm.
And so this was in the 80s, right? When he took on this movement to censor popular music, censor rock lyrics, right? What was going on then?
Yeah, that was in 85. And it was a group in D.C., included Tipper Gore and James Baker's wife, Susan Baker, and other people. They were trying to censor music full stop. They were trying to prevent. There was a list they had called the Filthy 15 that were 15 pop album singles that had what they considered to be profane, either sexually related to sex or violence. Zappa and many other people from the record industry complained, and they formed a Senate hearing, and Zappa fully intended to be one of many going to lend his voice on behalf of artists to preserve, to protect their rights. And when he got there, there was nobody there but him, I think Dee Snider and John Denver. And really, the people that were there, I guess with the exception of Dee Snider, weren't people who were on the Filthy 15. So nobody was coming after Zappa's music. He ended up giving an extremely eloquent testimonial, which is absolutely extraordinary. And he reduced the threat from actual censorship of the music itself to a warning label smacked on the album and nothing of the album being disturbed, which was fine with the artist.
I think a lot of the aspects of this was this music could be, you know, falling into young and impressionable minds. And, you know, Frank was all in favor of, hey, just print the lyrics on the back of the records, you know, so that people can have the information and don't try to stigmatize or censor, you know, the artists. And I think at the end of the day, it did turn into, a warning label that we're all familiar with, but it would have been a way worse situation. They would have not released records because someone used the F word or something, you know, that, which is ridiculous.
I want to talk about him personally, and you have interviews with former bandmates of his from, you know, Mothers of Invention. And I always want to play a clip from Bunk Gardner because, I mean, he was talking about, of course, how visionary Frank Zappa was and very demanding, just demanding perfection. Rehearsals would last many, many, many hours. It seems like the band members you interviewed were just in awe of him, but also a little afraid of him. Here's a clip from Bunk Gardner.
In the 4 years I was with Frank, he shook my hand once and said, good job. I don't ever remember Frank embracing somebody. Maybe that was his environment when he was growing up. So I kind of accepted that as, don't get too close, okay? And I didn't.
And I guess that's a recurring theme in the interviews with the people who knew him. There's one part where Frank is saying, oh, he doesn't have any friends. He has his family, but he doesn't have any friends. Let's start with Alex from the friend point of view and the bandmate point of view. What kind of boss, what kind of friend was he?
To me, it was kind of part and parcel of the duality of his nature. And not to say that every human being doesn't have duality. I think they all do. But Frank's was that he could be viewed as a martinet, someone who was really aloof and exacting, but also someone who was intensely collaborative and would be very deeply rooted or connected to the people he was with. And he was the same with journalists. He would often disparage journalists and the press. And yet I found hour after hour after hour of private tapes that he had where he would bring journalists and other people over to his house and enter into really intense dialogues with him, not him pontificating in a narcissistic way, but genuinely, curiously engaging in dialogue. So that was really, it was a much more nuanced reality than the general narrative of Frank being this hard taskmaster that nobody could get to know.
Amit, what was he like as a dad?
I mean, when you had his attention, he was totally dialed in. He was always a very present individual. Comedy was the currency in the household. And, you know, maybe it's because I saw him so infrequently, I guess, in comparison to my experiences going over to friends' houses, you know, because Frank would either be on tour or he'd just be, you know, the hours that he kept were just different. You know, he'd work all night and sleep during the day. So every time you'd spend time with him was eventized, you know, and it was really, really fun to be in, you know, his tractor beam. And I found him to be, you know, the most like huggy, huggable person. You know, I think in some of those interviews, you know, relationships can evolve and like he was definitely closer to some musicians more than others. And I think what Alex did is it's really honest film, kind of getting everyone's influences and their honest opinions. And because all of it's true, you know, he was definitely complex. But, you know, at home, he was an awesome dad. He wasn't someone you played baseball with. You'd you know.
Can't imagine playing baseball with Frank Zappa.
Yeah, no, he wasn't like that. He was someone, at least for me, I think he saw, both of my parents saw us individually and knew what our interests were. I was an ideal want for nothing, really super artistic, magical experience. And I wish that they were both still here.
Yeah. And your dad died when he was just 52, so young, of prostate cancer. Yeah. How old were you when he died?
I think I was just turning 19. And, you know, they gave him 3 months to live, and he lived for 3 years fighting the tough battle with cancer. And this is right at that tipping point where, you know, there's so much more that people can do if they realize they have prostate cancer. It was not as survivable as it is now. You know, for those of anyone who's listening, if you've ever lost someone to cancer, I feel you. I know how lame that is. And how painful that experience could be. And my heart goes out to, you know, everyone.
Well, Hona, thank you so much for coming on today, talking about your dad, and Alex talking about your movie.
Yeah, it was great to be here. Thank you so much.
Yeah. That's Amit Zappa, producer of the film Zappa, about his dad, Frank Zappa. And Alex Winter is director of it. You can see Zappa beginning November 27th.
Well, I'm about to get upset. Watching my TV, checking out the news, I tell my eyeballs fail to see. I mean to say that every day is just another rotten mess. And when it's gonna change, my friend, is anybody's guess. So I'm watching it.
And that'll do it for us today on Press Play. Don't forget, you can download or subscribe to our podcast. It's at kcw.com/pressplay or wherever else you get your podcasts. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Wednesday, I watch the riot.